listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos, Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Power to the People, the sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, March 5th, 2017.
In all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those three that see together, we hear some version of this story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. And in all three Gospels, the action that immediately precedes the temptations in the wilderness is the story of Jesus' baptism, which concludes this way. When Jesus had been baptized, just as he came up from the water, suddenly the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. In him I am well pleased." What follows doesn't make sense. Let's hear it again from the Message translation with a few added comments by your pastor. Next, immediately after having been told he was the Beloved and the Son of God, in whom God was pleased, next, Jesus was taken into the wild by the Spirit for a test. The devil was ready to give it. Jesus prepared for the test by fasting 40 days and 40 nights. That left him, of course, in a state of extreme hunger, which the devil took advantage of in the first test. "Since you are the Son of God," he said, his voice dripping with sarcasm and innuendo, "speak the word that will turn these stones into loaves of bread." Jesus answered by quoting Deuteronomy, "It takes more than bread to stay alive. It takes a steady stream of words from God's mouth." For the second test, the devil took him to the holy city. He sat him on top of the temple and said, "Since you are God's son, jump." The devil goaded him by quoting Psalm 91. "God has placed you in the care of angels. They will catch you so you won't so much as stub your toe." Jesus countered with another citation from Deuteronomy. "Don't you dare test the Lord your God." For the third test, the devil took him to the peak of a huge mountain. He gestured expansively, pointing out all the earth's kingdoms, how glorious they all were. Then he said, "They're yours, lock, stock, and barrel. Just go down on your knees and worship me, and they're yours." Jesus' refusal was curt. "Beat it, Satan." He backed his rebuke with a third quotation from Deuteronomy. "Worship the Lord your God and only him. Serve him with absolute single-heartedness." The test was over. The devil left, and in his place, angels. Angels came and took care of Jesus' needs. Now, before we dig into discerning what this passage, which always appears on the first Sunday of Lent, may have to offer us in our own journeys and in our own lives of seeking and following, first, some context. This is a true story, and it may have happened this way. But as early as the second century, commentators were saying, you know, there is no hill from which you can see all of the kingdoms of the world. Just keep that in mind if you're struggling with this being a text you must take literally. It's a true story, and it could have happened that way. Also, in Greek, the word devil is diabolos, which is the same word that in Hebrew is Satan. Now, in Jewish thought, Satan is a member of the heavenly court. His role is to test the righteous. Sometimes this gets translated as the accuser. We may be familiar with that from the book of Job. This devil is neither a figure of absolute evil, nor an opposite and almost equal power to God, which develops in some Christian traditions later. But still, he's a nasty character, and rooting for the one being tested to fail. The wilderness into which the Spirit led Jesus. Throughout the scripture, wilderness represents not just a place of testing and trial and tribulation, but also a place of preparation. A place for waiting for God and learning to trust in God. For 40 days and 40 nights, Jesus remains in the wilderness without food, preparing for what will come next. 40 is also the number of days and nights that Noah and his family endured the deluge on the ark, after which God made a covenant never again to destroy the earth with a flood. 40 are the days and nights Moses fasted on Mount Sinai as he inscribed the words of God's covenant for the Israelites. 40 are the days and nights that Elijah fasted in the desert before receiving a new commission from God. 40 are the years that the Israelites wandered in the wilderness in preparation for their arrival in the Promised Land. 40 are Jesus' days in the wilderness. In a sermon titled Lenten Discipline, included in the volume Home by Another Way, Barbara Brown Taylor gives a wonderful description of how Lent, the season we are entering, came to be. Now, some of you may recognize Barbara Brown Taylor from her more recent and beloved books, An Altar in the World and Learning to Walk in the Dark. But this is from an earlier volume of her sermons. I quote her at some length because I really can't say it better than she has. Do not bother looking for Lent in your Bible dictionary, because there was no such thing back then. There is some evidence that early Christians fasted for 40 hours between Good Friday and Easter. And I would interject that that tradition is still alive in some of the more liturgical churches. I know that I took part in that when I was part of the Episcopal Church, and I have never once again managed it once I joined the UCC, because I cannot do it alone, and I'm the food preparer in my family. But back to Reverend Taylor. The custom of spending 40 days in prayer and self-denial did not arise until later, when the initial rush of Christian adrenaline was over, and believers had gotten very ho-hum about their faith. The world did not end as Jesus himself had said it would, so his followers stopped expecting quite so much from God and from themselves. They hung a wooden cross on the wall and settled back into their more or less comfortable routines, remembering their once passionate devotion to God the way they remembered the other passions of their youth. Oh, to be young again, and to believe that everything is possible. Little by little, Christians became devoted to their comforts instead. The soft couch, the flannel sheets, the leg of lamb roasted with rosemary. These things made them feel safe and cared for, if not by God, then by themselves. They decided there was no contradiction between being comfortable and being Christian. And before long, it was very hard to pick them out from the population at large. They no longer distinguished themselves by their bold love for one another. You may remember that in the book of Acts, we are told that they, at first, held all things in common, and there was a special role for a person whose job it was to make sure that there was no widow or orphan or poor one who was left out, and that there was no rich one who was holding back while others were in need. They didn't follow that path anymore. They did not get arrested for championing the poor. They blended in. They avoided extremes. They decided to be nice instead of being holy, and God moaned out loud. Hearing the sound of God moaning, someone suggested it was time to call Christians back to their senses. And the Bible offered clues about how to do that. Israel, Elijah, Moses, Jesus also spent periods of preparation and learning to trust God. So the church announced a season of Lent, which comes from the old English word Lenten, which just means spring, the season of Easter, and also a springtime for the soul. That close quote from Reverend Taylor. 40 days to reorient oneself, to remember that we live by God's grace, and that the creature comforts we give ourselves at the very first whim, the power we think is our due, and the stuff of the world that we admire with the force of worship, the stuff that we acquire and then invest our sense of identity in, we have all these things out of proportion. I find the story of Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness compelling because of this commentary on what it's like to be human, what temptations arise, and how confusing power is. The tempter said to him, "If you are the Son of God, you have the power to." We in the church have pretty conflictual relationships with power. I suspect how each of us is oriented towards power is determined by our race, our age, gender, birth order within our family, our financial success, or not, and how many unforeseen roadblocks we have encountered in either our private or our professional lives. But this is Jesus we're talking about. He had just been declared the Son of God, the Beloved. He should have had power, right? Well, and so should we, created in the image of God. And as the author of the Gospel of John reminds us, to those who believed, God gave the power to become children of God. But as Jesus quickly points out to the wily accuser by quoting scripture, it is not power that is wrong, it's the misuse of that power. In fact, later in Matthew's gospel, it is, in fact, Jesus' deeds of power, the phrase that is used, his deeds of power, his healings, feedings, teaching, calming even the storm, that alert people to who he is. So it can't be just plain power that is wrong. Unlike Jesus, who knew who he was and knew how to use his power well, we often get confused. We don't often love ourselves especially well, and so we sometimes move to one of two extremes. Assuming we deserve more power than those around us, we assume this even to the point of not realizing we're doing it, and we become part of systems that unfairly advantage us because of our race or gender. For more on that, please join the Lenten study. At the other end of the spectrum, we pretend that we have no power at all. And sometimes we convince ourselves of this. This is a move that I personally have sometimes made in personal relationships, in work relationships. And of course, it is untrue. I am a person on the planet. But because I felt disempowered, and like all healthy human beings, needed some power, I sometimes found underhanded and manipulative ways to exercise power. Now, I hope it won't strike you as odd to mention, but 40 is also the average number of weeks of a human pregnancy. And in my experience, there is something both set apart and, of course, full of preparation about a pregnancy. One is preparing physically, emotionally, and spiritually in the experience of carrying a child. I have had two hoped-for, joyfully welcomed pregnancies, each of which resulted in a healthy child. One was simple and uncomplicated. The other was difficult, included 5 weeks of bed rest and a one-month premature baby. Both included the paradox of human power and powerlessness. I felt enormously powerful on the one hand. As a friend put it to me, when I got up heavily during the 8th month of my pregnancy with Caleb, I got up to help set up chairs for a picnic And she said to me, "Sit down, sit down. You're very busy right now creating a human." The women of Borneo had a similar response to Margaret Mead. She questioned them at one point and asked, "Aren't you jealous of the men? They bar you not just from the religious ceremonies, but from the very buildings where the ceremonies take place." And the women looked at her as if this was the most nonsensical question they could have heard. And they said, "Jealous of them? The men? We made them. We'll make more." But also, even in my first healthy, easy, uncomplicated pregnancy, I felt completely powerless. Not much of what was happening day to day was under my control. I could take precautions, exercise well, eat well, sleep well, and increase the odds of all things going well. But I could not determine even the day of the delivery, much less its outcome. A time of trust and a time of preparation indeed, and a time to be both powerful and yielded to God. As we enter Lent, I wonder if Jesus' state when the devil got to him, alone, famished, is anything like the state we get in when we come to one of those places in life where all our usual protections are stripped away and we are left with the uncomfortable gap, the emptiness that is there below all our striving. I know my tendency when I am out of sorts, away from my prayer routines, and I start to feel that anxiety, that loneliness, that edginess, my tendency is to fill it up with words. Novels, puzzles, songs, phone conversations. Most recently, it has been an addictive turning to Facebook, which is where I find links to news stories. And that, of course, is my rationalization, the story I tell myself. This is a responsible use of my free time. I follow the New York Times and the Washington Post, the Guardian and the BBC. I'm just being a good citizen. I'm being well informed. I know that for me, for right now, this is an unhealthy behavior because it numbs me for the moment. But when I put the phone down, the anxiety that I had been trying to keep at bay comes creeping back in, and I go for another hit. So I've decided that for these 40 days of Lent, I will do without Facebook. On Wednesday, the first day of Lent, my thumb hit the Facebook icon about 6 times before my brain even knew what it was doing. That's how connected I was. I had to hide the icon from myself on my separate screen, away from my calendar and my clock app. Those things are practical tools, and they don't call to me with that siren song of numbing. Now, when I have a few still moments, instead of clicking and scrolling, I am pausing to look around me more, and more appreciatively. If I run into one of those moments of stillness which feels unformed and uneasy, instead of running to someone else's words to fill it up, I am taking a deep breath and sitting with my discomfort until something else dawns. Comedian Louis C.K. told a talk show host recently about a similar experience he was having and about why he won't allow his own children to have cell phones. He wants his kids to know how to be unhappy, how to sit in unease, because there is something very rich on the other side of it. He tells the story on himself of being in his car and having that hollowness rise up in him. He said, "I started to reach for the radio, and then I said to myself, 'No, don't do it.' He felt worse and worse. Every lousy thing he had ever done scrolled through his mind. Every way he had half-hearted it, when his wife or children needed his wholehearted participation. His life felt empty. his accomplishments hollow, and he was just disgusted with himself. So he pulled the car over, sat there, and let the hopelessness and sense of worthlessness just wash over him. And he burst out crying. He cried and he cried. And then when he was done, peace settled down around him, and something like joy. Maybe he even heard the daughter of a sound. Because he did not numb over. This Lent, I encourage you to find a discipline that feels right for you. Maybe that's some kind of fast from your go-to comfort food. Now, I don't mean the kind of comfort food which you make yourself and serve with love and which is nourishing, but the kind which in reality makes you feel a little bit gross when you're done eating, because it's not a healthy thing to start with, and you have trouble limiting your portion. Or perhaps a fast from technology. Not the technology which helps you do your work or stay in touch with your loved ones. Not even the technology which genuinely delights or relaxes you. But the stuff you consume obsessively to avoid feeling your own feelings. Like me with Facebook. Perhaps you're in a place in life where enough has been taken away from you. And your discipline could be a daily time of receiving. A time of stillness and listening and leaning into the endless ocean of God's love. Perhaps you are in a season where being alone is overwhelming, and your discipline will be in allowing someone to tend to you and to affirm your belovedness. After many years of priesthood and life in community, Henri Nouwen wrote, "Over the years, I have come to realize the greatest trap in our life is not success, popularity, or power, but self-rejection. When we have come to believe the voices that call us worthless and unlovable, in those moments, success, popularity, and power are easily perceived as attractive solutions. But it is the self-rejection which must be addressed. Self-rejection is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life because it contradicts the sacred voice that calls us the beloved. Being the beloved constitutes the core truth of our existence. The misuse and misplacement of power, which obscures our belovedness and can harm the belovedness of others, is an ongoing temptation. But God gives us holy power to become God's children, to become our true selves. God gives us the paradoxical power of being vulnerable and authentic, the power to bless and the power to speak truth in a lying world. May this Lent work in all of us powerfully to bring us peace."
Listen, listen, God is speaking to you.